You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In all the writings about how the Nazi Party came to power, little attention has generally been paid to how the many Americans living in Germany interpreted what was going on. Journalists, diplomats, and intellectuals corresponded within Europe and with the United States regularly, and these records form a revealing narrative of the early days of the Third Reich. Joining us now is former Newsweek foreign correspondent Andrew Nagorski, author of Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased to welcome him. Right now, he is vice president and director of public policy at the East-West Institute to our show. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
How did you first come to realize that there was this rich textual evidence about this period?
You know, oddly enough, I was a correspondent in Berlin and before that in Bonn. And while I'd written a lot about this period and the after effects of this period, I never really seriously thought about what must have been like to be, in effect, a predecessor of mine, a foreign correspondent in Germany or a diplomat or someone coming through. And when I realized that so much of it was overshadowed by what happened next, that people didn't think about the fact that Berlin was this great magnet for Americans and everybody else.
Because it was a major city in Europe. It was a cultural center.
It was the cultural center. We tend to think of Paris in the 20s and London to some extent. But in fact, Berlin was even a greater draw. It was, you know, here was Bertolt Brecht writing plays, Marlene Dietrich, and you know, performing in movies, and George Grosz painting. You know, it was a wonderful place in many ways.
But I can't imagine it was typical of what was going on in Germany. Often, American journalists were criticized for reporting from the Soviet Union out of Moscow when that was really a very limited picture of what was going on in that country. Yes. Beijing would be the same sort of thing for China.
Well, in fact, you could, as an American correspondent or an American writer, travel around Germany in the 20s, and even for much of the 30s, even once Hitler took power, more freely than you could when you were in the Soviet Union in the communist days.
But was Berlin doing all that well despite the fact that Germany was going through so many economic problems as a result of all the fallout after World War I?
Well, it was doing terribly in terms of economically. It was a mess. It lost World War I, 2 million men killed. The country was undergoing hyperinflation. Psychologically, the country was falling apart. Politically, there were groups of right and left. There was incredible mayhem. But at the same time, there was this cultural revival, this free-for-all spirit, this sense that, wow, anything goes in this town.
Including the city was the sexual mores were fairly free-spirited, for example. We've seen that in the musical Cabaret. Was that pretty accurate?
Yes, I think in terms of capturing the spirit, Cabaret was pretty accurate. I think what you had Edgar Maurer, for instance, was a Chicago Daily News correspondent, one of the best correspondents of that era, and he said there was no more tolerant place than Berlin. He meant sexual mores, straight, gay, whatever, but also in terms of just the freewheeling, you could experiment with any aspect of life.
On the other hand, the infrastructure was becoming more and more dilapidated, and there were a lot of poor people.
Oh, yes. There was incredible poverty. I mean, when you had hyperinflation where suddenly you were talking about not thousands of marks, but millions of marks, trillions of marks, money became totally worthless, and you had the proverbial wheelbarrows full of money. People's savings were wiped out. Yes, there was poverty, and this was, of course, fertile ground for extremists of both the right and the left.
How did the Nazis view Berlin in these early years? They were pretty much centered in Munich, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Hitler lived in Munich. He had come there as soon as he was demobilized in World War I, and he had joined the party when it was a tiny movement. And he viewed Berlin very suspiciously. He saw it as this decadent place, this place that didn't have the nationalist fervor of Bavaria, and that attitude, to a large extent, continued even after he took power.
Now, I can imagine when you're researching this sort of story, you could go back to all the published material in newspapers and magazines, Was that where the richest trove was, or were you able to gain access to personal letters, dispatches, and other things that might have told very different kinds of stories?
Well, I of course looked for all the published material that I'd ever as a starting point, and there are many out of print memoirs and correspondence that have been published. That was interesting, but the most interesting thing, and the real reason why I felt this was a topic worth pursuing, that in Hitlerland I managed to sort of put the reader in, if it succeeds, in the eyes of the Americans at the time without the benefit of hindsight. And there, their diaries, their letters, their unpublished memoirs in many cases, which I got from various archives, family collections, literally from people's attics in some cases.
Including an American wife of a German official.
Yes, yes. There were wives. Some of the most interesting unpublished accounts came from American wives of German officials, or from of fairly famous Americans of that era, who were overshadowed by their husbands' exploits, but who had incredible firsthand observations.
My guest is Andrew Nagorski. His latest book, Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. So some of these people were living there just because they were married. They had other reasons to be there. Many were there for professional reasons.
Yes, of course. There were the journalists, the diplomats, the businessmen. They were there for professional reasons. And then you had many famous Americans who just came there because it was such an interesting place. Thomas Wolfe, Sinclair Lewis, Dorothy Thompson, you know, as a reporter. But they were attracted to this story.
Were American Jews already feeling a little uncomfortable there?
Oh, yes. They were, although it's interesting to say one of the first American correspondents after World War I is a man by the name of Ben Hecht, who later on became a very famous Hollywood writer, but he comes in his early 20s after World War I, and he makes a point of saying, I'm the first American Jewish correspondent here. And he wrote in his memoir years later, I never experienced any anti-Semitism. In fact, the anti-Semitism in the U.S. was much worse. I think he was overstating it. Obviously, there was anti-Semitism. There was a lot of nasty racism already taking place. But he was making the point that the U.S. at that point could not be complacent. There was plenty of anti-Semitism in the U.S.
But Hitler did not arise out of a vacuum. In fact, there were pre-Hitlers who were saying pretty much the same sort of thing.
Oh, of course, yes. There were many, many people who said the same sort of thing, but one of the really fascinating things for me to observe of these people, and including the first Americans to meet Hitler, is what do they notice, and what do they notice about their rhetoric, and do they take that rhetoric seriously? Because for all of us, it's a little hard to say, suddenly someone says something as outrageous as Hitler was saying, do you think that he really means it?
So let's talk about some of them. Karl Henry von Weigand, reporter for the Hearst Publications. He followed Hitler's story quite closely. He was a German, so did that help?
Well, he was actually an American. He was born in Germany, came over. He's a very colorful character. Came over to the United States when he was about 10 years old. His father was a farmer in Iowa. He disappears and runs away from home, actually works for Buffalo Bill for a while, then becomes a wire service reporter, comes to Europe because he speaks German. And he is the first American journalist to meet Hitler in 1922.
Was he impressed?
He was quite impressed. In fact, he said, this is, he was impressed. He recognized him as an extremist, and he called him a demagogue. But he said, this guy has real organizational skills. He's got oratorical skills. And Mussolini had just taken power in Italy. And he said, well, this guy could one day maybe become the future dictator of Bavaria, which in 1922, remember, Hitler is still only a local agitator at that point, is a pretty interesting read.
Truman Smith, who was a junior military attaché, met Hitler during this time. He described him as a marvelous demagogue. So he saw him as a demagogue but didn't really have any sense of how dangerous the man could be.
Oh, I think Truman Smith is, again, a very interesting character. He's 29 years old, a junior military attaché at that time from a distinguished family from Connecticut. And he he says, a marvelous demagogue, and he says, yeah, he points out the anti-Semitic rhetoric. But again, he says, this guy, given the conditions in Germany and how dangerous they are, he could go far. Marvelous, I think, can be misread here. He says, this guy has talent, which is interesting. One of the original things I thought early on was that it would be a gradual learning curve for the Americans in Germany about Hitler, but it wasn't necessarily.
When was Mein Kampf published?
Mein Kampf was published, well, first of all, Hitler dictated it
when he was in prison.
So after the failed beer hall putsch of 1923. So 1924, he dictates it in prison, rather cushy conditions in prison, and then it comes out afterwards.
And were people paying attention to what he had written?
Well, he, of course, made it his party Bible. It wasn't until he came into power that it became required, basically, for all Germans to have it. But the thing is about Mein Kampf is that it's largely impenetrable. If you really, unless you have to, it's very hard to read. And even Nazi officials often admitted it privately, I didn't get through this turgid tome.
Otto Strasser, an early follower of Hitler who later broke with him and escaped Germany, recalled a dinner with several top Nazi officials in 1927, and it became apparent that few of them had read Mein Kampf all the way through. So they decided to stick anyone who with the bill who hadn't read it, and nobody had read it, so everyone had to pay his own way.
Yeah, it's a marvelous little episode that Strasser recalls. But the chilling part of it is, of course, the people didn't read it who should have read it, and especially when Hitler gets closer to power, and people in the West as well. And the best, say, American correspondents, like William Shiren said, would say, read Mein Kampf, take it seriously.
Now, many Americans living in Berlin at the time talked about the Americanization of the city. Is that one of the reasons they were kind of fooled? Because they saw it moving in a different kind of direction?
Well, we're talking about the 1920s still, when Germany feels like it has the Weimar Republic, it's a democratic society, chaotic but democratic. And they, yes, there is a first push for Americanization. Americans were very popular. They entered World War I against Germany, but late in the war, and then they were not vengeful like the French. So they were seen as popular, and jazz was popular, Hollywood movies were popular, mass production was entering, and it was all seen as part of this American scene. So Americans felt very welcome there.
Weigand spoke to Hitler again in December 1929. How long had he been out of prison?
Well, by that time he'd been out of prison 5 years. And remember, in the mid-20s, Germany, the Weimar Republic, seemed to stabilize. That crisis of the economy begins to ebb, and partly through American loans and American help. And so it isn't until the Depression hits that Weigand and other correspondents begin to say, we better go back and pay attention to Hitler. In fact, the Nazis in the mid-20s, when things were going well, we're not getting any attention.
So how fast did Hitler's movement grow? At the time of the putsch, how many people were in his movement? How many were in it after he got out of prison?
After he got out of prison, it was in very bad shape. It was really a tiny movement. And it didn't until the Depression. The most I think they got in terms of parliamentary seats was 12 out of more than 500. So it tells you something. Then, of course, then it begins to explode.
My guest is Andrew Nagorski. His latest book is called Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You mentioned Dorothy Thompson was there. She was the most famous American woman correspondent, and she had an opportunity to interview Hitler in November 1931. She turned it into a short book called I Saw Hitler! Made a big splash in the States. So how did she see him?
Well, this is what is really remarkable. As I mentioned, some of the early Americans who met Hitler really estimated his potential reasonably well. Dorothy Thompson comes in when he's already leading a big party and an up-and-coming party. She goes in and meets him, and then her first line is, I thought I was going in to meet the future dictator of Germany. Within 50 seconds, I realized I was not. Such was the startling insignificance of this man. And she goes on to describe him as this rather weird, politician with these jerky motions, a somewhat effeminate side, which, by the way, was something many American correspondents wrote about Hitler, and somehow that they would not have a chance against the quote-unquote more manly German politicians, that even if he took power, he would be easily manipulated by others. Of course, a colossal, colossal misjudgment.
Well, that's because they didn't understand how things were going to progress also. Hitler might not have come to power if certain other things hadn't happened.
Yes, that's true. And one thing I think anybody reading these accounts in Hitlerland, I think put yourself in the shoes there with that and try to blot out hindsight and think whether or not you would have done any better. And you know, Dorothy Thompson, to her credit, later figures it out and becomes much, much tougher. But I think what was the reason why Dorothy Thompson and some others got it wrong was they just judged by the interview and sort of by their standards. Those who went and actually saw Hitler at rallies and his theatrical ability, his ability to play to the crowd, his knowledge of psychology, got a very different picture.
Like somebody you mentioned earlier, Edgar Ansel Maurer,
yes,
a Berlin correspondent for the Chicago Daily News. And he noticed a 13-year-old American boy who attended school in Berlin telling his father that he wanted to join the Nazi Party.
Yes, because he was this 13-year-old American boy was in an American school, in a German school, and all his friends were becoming little Nazis. And you know, you know the power of conformity at that age for anybody, and it seemed like to be part of the cool crowd, you had to be a Nazi.
So did Maurer write that Hitler was dangerous?
Oh yes, Maurer was one of the best correspondents. He, in fact, was he was there throughout much of the 1920s and was driven out after Hitler took power. But he was the one who was writing, this is highly dangerous. First of all, he said, don't believe the German politicians who think they can keep this guy in check. They're not going to keep this guy in check. He was telling German Jews, get out of this country. These guys are not kidding.
But it wasn't just Americans who misread what was going on. It was Germans as well.
Absolutely.
And that's why so many of the Jews stayed, and other people who opposed Hitler, who just didn't think that he had a chance. But he was quite clever in maneuvering himself politically, and actually got Paul von Hindenburg, the president, who considered him a real threat, to appoint him chancellor.
Yes. Well, by that time, Hindenburg was almost senile. So it was really Franz von Papen and some of the other politicians who maneuvered that, thinking von Papen famously, who had been a chancellor, then vice chancellor, said, you know, we have basically Hitler in our pocket. We'll get him into power, and then we'll be able to control him completely.
And the opposite, of course, happened.
Absolutely.
And very quickly, he seized real power. You read about Howard K. Smith. Many people will remember him from his days in television. He was just out of college, arrived in Germany in 1936, and he reported both on the country and on how his reaction to it changed over time. Can you describe his theory about how Americans evolved in their thinking about Germany?
Yeah, Howard K. Smith had, I thought, one of the best, most succinct theories. He said this, he's talking about the 30s, once Hitler has come to power, but still early days when people are still trying to figure out what is this man, what is his movement. First impression of many outsiders, especially Americans, was, wow, this is an orderly place. It's a lot nicer. There's no longer this economic crisis. German villages along the Rhine are so beautiful, so forth. Second.
I actually remember reading a National Geographic from the early 30s. Well, I mean, after Hitler had attained power, in which they talked about how the Hitler Youth were like America's Boy Scouts and how they helped old ladies cross the street. It was kind of shocking to read it. So there were a lot of Americans who were snowed.
Oh, yes, they were snowed. Even the militarization of the society was somehow seen in those initial stages, the second stage, as kind of something glamorous. All these guys with shiny boots and young handsome men parading about. And then Smith recounts the next stage where people begin to say, what is it? You know, boy, there all these what is this military for? It's to kill. And then finally, the fourth stage, if people get to it, is of absolute horror and realizing the world is not ready for this.
Although there were some people who admired Hitler from this country, Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, famously.
Yes, Charles Lindbergh, although I would say Henry Ford was an anti-Semite, and in fact Hitler had a photo of him over his desk, but as much probably because of his mass production of cars, which Hitler emulated with the Volkswagen. But Charles Lindbergh is an interesting story, and this is, again, in the book, one of the things I found was to revisit some of these stories. Like, we all know that Lindbergh had pro-German sympathies. What I hadn't realized, that Truman Smith, the same military attaché I talk about in the early 20s, who comes back in the mid-30s, is the one who plants the idea with Hermann Göring, the air ministry, to invite Charles Lindbergh as the biggest celebrity of the time. And the reason he does that is because the Americans he doesn't have much of a fix on what the German Air Force is doing. And they know it's ratcheting it up. He knows about the army. And he knows that if Lindbergh is invited, Hermann Göring, who likes to show off, will show off everything. And that's exactly what happened. So Lindbergh plays a valuable intelligence role, whatever his political leanings and motives.
There were a lot of people in Britain who sympathize, the Mosley family, for example. Should I assume that there were other American reporters who saw this differently, saw Hitler as doing something wonderful?
Well, there were...
As time progressed?
Yes. I mean, there were, of the American reporters, most of them, if they were inclined initially to be, as they said, quote-unquote neutral, you could see them progress pretty quickly, except for a few who actually later on collaborated and became... worked for German radio, propaganda radio, but most of the reporters did not, and they became, if they had illusions, they had rapid turnarounds.
And were they forced to leave when the war broke out?
Not immediately. Remember, when the war breaks out, I mean, when you talk about World War II, when Germany invades Poland in 1939, U.S. is not in the war. So I take my story in Hitlerland all the way from the end of World War I through the internment of the last American diplomats and journalists after Pearl Harbor until they are actually exchanged. And that's also one of these little-known chapters of American presence in Europe.
When did they become aware of the concentration camps?
You have some American reporters, and as I recount in the book, actually being taken to concentration camps in the late 30s. This is before the Wannsee Conference, before the full-scale Holocaust.
To be shown how humane they were.
These were show trips, and political prisoners were there, some Jews, and they were but some of the political prisoners managed to signal very clearly that what you're seeing is not what's really happening.
Well, we've heard other stories about people coming to Washington and going to London and talking about the horrors of the concentration camp and being ignored because it was politically expedient to not become too horrified by them.
Yes. Remember, everybody, no one, not even the most, sort of from right to left, not just the America First movement and so forth, no one was eager to get into another European conflict, and there were a lot of efforts to signal what was going on in Europe, and some of these best reporters and diplomats who had a hard time getting a hearing on that.
You were the Newsweek bureau chief in Berlin after, I'm assuming, unification.
Yes, I was in Bonn in the 80s before unification.
Andrew Nagorski's latest book is Hitlerland, American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.